This is Fresh Air. No one could accuse Clive Barker of not having a rich fantasy life. From his earliest novels, The Book of Blood, The Damnation Game, In the Flesh, he has uniquely blended horror with eroticism. Barker is said to be the guy that Stephen King considers scary. Besides his novels, and they're nearly 10 by now, he's directed the movie versions of his books, including Hellraiser, Hellbound, and Nightbreed. Children are being introduced to his world through comic book versions of his stories, and next year Barker will publish his first children's book. In his last few books, Barker has moved from horror fiction to something more fantastic. Imagica is Barker's latest novel, in which he's created a complex fantasy world. The title refers to a universe of five dominions. Earth is one of those dominions ruled by a tyrannical leader. Barker told me that he's not that different from most novelists who create their own worlds.
I think every novelist considers his or herself a minor divinity. I think that the writer of the Fantastique is much more likely to want to sit down on a mountaintop and say, okay, the world is relatively bare, let me begin it.
This world that you've created, and the kind of mythology and mythological creatures in the world that you have created, do you think people want... need somehow a kind of mythology, that there is a kind of barrenness
absolutely.
A lot of the way people live their lives and these sort of large, as you say, fantastique kind of universes meets the kind of need for mythology?
Yes, I think we must be clear, though, that the need is not a neurotic need, because I think very often it's thought to be and it isn't, and that the work isn't necessarily escapism. Game shows are escapism. Presidential addresses are escapism. Confrontation with the mythologies in us, confrontations with the spiritual possibilities of our lives can actually be ways to stir up all kinds of thoughts and ideas in us. I'm a Jungian, and I believe passionately in the collective unconscious. I believe there are images and ideas which are constants across cultures. And in Imagica, for the first time, I've dared to do something which I simply wouldn't have had the courage to do 3-4 years ago, which is reconfigure the Christian myth. And if we take Jung as the gospel for a moment and accept the power that Jung ascribes to mythologies in our lives, then finding new ways to tell those potent tales of our culture and asking people to reassess them, which is something that Imagica does, in, I hope, a very entertaining and sexy package, but nevertheless that's what it's hoping to do, that seems to be a very important thing to do.
One of the characters I find interesting is Paiopa, who is a mestif, who's kind of characterized by having the ability to be both genders.
Right.
You seem to be saying that sexuality doesn't fit very neatly into the categories of male and female, that there's a lot in between,
Absolutely. Lot
of sort of undefined sexuality that
Absolutely.
Most people probably don't explore or even try to understand.
Well, I think that in the last 10 years we've seen a rise of a whole psychological movement which is about the male finding the female inside him and the female looking to find the male. I mean, whether we look at Robert Bly, whether we look at a whole body of writers dealing with the problems of gender definition. In our culture, the old means of gender definition are sort of a bit redundant. You know, I do very little hunting daily now. And you know, women do far less domestic work sitting at home looking after their children.
Or scrubbing the clothes by the river.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Though my mother does do that still. We have a very nice river in Liverpool. But no, exactly right. Those definitions don't pertain any longer. And I think what we get, therefore, is this sort of cultural caricature of those roles, which is actually repugnant. We get Sylvester Stallone on the one hand, and we get the oversized mammaries of Playboy on the other hand.
Well, I think what that represents is people clinging with desperation to these models of
and sort of caricaturing them, because they still excite the old system somehow or other. And the dormant part of the meek accountant's mind is excited by the image of the ultimate hunter-gatherer Sylvester Stallone as he sits watching Rambo. This is this has to go. But what we need in its place are new metaphors. Metaphors which are making sense to our consciousness. And part of my problem with the Fantastique as a narrative model, as it appears at the end of the 20th century, is how unambiguous and unparadoxical it's become, how much it's a business of the bad guys versus the good guys, how much horror fiction is a business of throwing the monster out into the ether, never to see it again, how much the Tolkien model, the Lord of the Rings model, has been used to divide the world up into those innocent, hairy-footed hobbits and the terrible, dark things that live in the mountains. This isn't the way the world is. The world is full of ambiguities, and I want that to find its way into my fiction.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Clive Barker, and he's back with another book. His latest book is called Imagica, and his films, and he's done several, include Hellraiser, Hellbound, and Nightbreed. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Clive Barker is my guest. Do you ever scare yourself?
No. No, these are my children. They may be twisted, they may be freakish, but I love them.
Did you ever scare your parents?
I still scare my parents. My parents are scared by the fact that there is such a huge audience for this stuff. I mean, that's what really, no.
It's the company you keep.
It really is. My mother and father are wonderful people. My mother's part Italian, my father's part Irish, very voluble. They're great storytellers, very excitable. And really wonderful people. They don't like this stuff. They don't understand this stuff. It's no part of their world. They're pragmatists. They were brought up at a time, they came to adulthood through the war. It was a very difficult time in England. They married during a time of great economic depression when there were still ration books and so on. They had to be pragmatists. That was necessary. I was, on the other hand, born into a lush time when my imagination was given a lot of freedom in my education, which my parents weren't.
Well, I wonder, even your doodling as a child, I mean, they must have come across some of your drawings or listened to the sort of stories you would
tell. They were deeply distressed, and I feel their distress was in part a response to pragmatists to the fact that they had given birth to a congenital dreamer. And what was this about? Where the hell did this come from?
Well, did they go so far as to take you to see a therapist somehow?
No, because in 1955 in England, therapy was something. There was probably only one therapist in all of England. I mean, therapy wasn't in, and even in England now, therapy doesn't have the same credence that it has here. So, I mean, that was never an option. They did take the pieces of paper and crayons away from me very regularly. Mm-hmm. They did try and make me draw houses and trains.
What did you draw? What were you drawing?
Dragons and demons, of course. But they were what my mind's eye was seeing. Uh-huh. And later, when I was 15 and 16, discovered William Blake, a story came to light there, which I particularly loved. Blake was walking on Peckham Rye with his mother and father and stopped at a tree and gazed up. And his mother and father, who were extremely sensible people, said, "What's the problem, Bill?" And William said, look at all the angels in this tree. And they looked up at what was clearly just a tree full of leaves as far as they were concerned. And I think they were wrong and Bill was right. And said, oh boy, dear, oh dear, I'm sure somebody's going to invent psychoanalysis really soon and we'll be very glad, and took little Bill away. And that tale moved me greatly because though until recently, certainly until a Magicka, I tend to have put emphasis upon the dragons and the demons, I was also seeing the angels. And that's a more and more an important part of my life.
Did that set you apart then also from kids that you might have been playing with?
Yes, but I didn't much mind that. I was a solitary, short-sighted, rotund little boy who didn't really care that I suppose I cared on sports day when I didn't, you know, I didn't get to play the games because I couldn't and didn't want to. But what I really cared about was having access to the secret world of the imagination and holding on to that. I felt through my childhood and actually through my university years too as though I was constantly besieged by pragmatists, besieged by the particulars of living a life. And I didn't want to live a life. I wanted to dream a life.
Were there people, though, that did encourage you, or was this really a solitary process?
There were a few, and I've thanked them at the beginning of books. There was the inevitable English teacher. I've spoken to Steve King about this. It seems to me as though we all writers have an English teacher somewhere there who was encouraging in an atmosphere where, you know, maybe encouragement was lacking elsewhere at home, perhaps.
And is one enough? I mean, one teacher is enough?
I think it's enough. I think all you need is one soul who will say to you, quietly perhaps, after the class is over, you know, hold on to this, because this is wonderful. And I only required that. It was actually one conversation at 4 o'clock in some autumn, sometime when I was 15 or 16, and it was all I needed.
You're working now on a book for children.
Mm-hmm.
Can you clue us in at all to what you're dealing with?
The first things that we put into the hands of our children are very important. We put Never Never Land and Oz and Wonderland into our children's hands, and then of course we take them away at the age of 4 and tell them they're wholly irrelevant to their lives. It's just a terrible thing to do. But my mother was wonderful. She put into my hands very early on Peter Pan and a little later Treasure Island, the Narnia books and so on. And then I discovered, I suppose at the age of 8 or 9, I discovered Ray Bradbury. And Something Wicked This Way Comes became my sacred text for 2 or 3 years. And the hold that those books and those worlds had upon my imagination was so fierce that I can still smell the feeling of those books. And I mean smell the feeling. I can still sense what it was to be involved in those worlds and walk with those characters and fly with those characters. And I thought it was time to see if I couldn't put into the hands of another generation a story or two like that.
Do you find you have to be more careful in the way you write for children?
Well, there's fewer cuss words and sex scenes. There is a real sense in which there's a continuum between the works of the fantastique and the things which I read when I was a child. The sense that the imagination is still the true law, perhaps the only real law, is something which is held over from childhood, from the fiction of childhood. You see, Paul is wrong when he says, now you're a man, you put away childish things. It's one of the fundamental lies of our culture that we divide into this thing called the child and this thing called the adult. What we do is we sublimate all the passions of childhood and very often do them the most terrible mischief in the process and do ourselves the most terrible mischief.
I wonder, too, in trying to get these ideas and your books into the hands of children, you have to go through parents, you have to go through teachers, librarians who might not believe quite all the things that you believe about childhood.
Of course, but I'm a proselytizer. You've noticed that. I think in a culture which celebrates so much banality, it's inevitable that one has to fight for a kind of fierceness of the imagination.
Well, I think it's nutrition. I think people are very interested in kind of nutritious kind of literature that's good for children, will make them into good citizens.
Yes, exactly right. And then good workers. I mean, there's a whole argument made about what you're trying to turn children into. And actually what you're trying to turn them into is engineering plant fodder, retail work fodder. And there's something else that we are born to, and it isn't 8 hours of reductive imagination-breaking work a day. There is the life of the soul. There's the life of the spirit.
So are you interested in turning children into subversives?
I think children are born subversives. And what I'm asking them to do is hold on to that part.
Clive Barker, thank you very much.
This has been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Clive Barker's newest novel is Imagica. This is Fresh Air.